Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Tom Murray. Tom serves as the Director of Innovation for Future Ready Schools, a project of the Alliance for Excellent Education located in Washington, D.C. He has testified before the United States Congress and has worked alongside that body, the U.S. Senate and the White House, the U.S. Department of Education and State Departments of Education, corporations, and school districts throughout the country to implement student-centered learning while helping to lead Future Ready Schools and Digital Learning Day. His most recent book, Personal and Authentic, Designing Learning Experiences That Impact a Lifetime, was released in October of 2019. Tom is one of the co-founders of hashtag EdTechChat, a weekly educational technology Twitter forum where hundreds of educators from all over the world discuss topics related to the effective use of educational technology. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Hey, Dana, what an honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I've been following Future Ready Schools for a while and have seen you talk with many leaders in the past year, especially in relation to ed tech, and I'm excited to talk to you today. But first of all, I'd like to ask you, tell me about a time when you came out of the trenches and what you learned from that experience.
Sure. And I can tell you over and over and over again when I failed or things that didn't go well and where I had to like pull myself back up, give myself that pep talk in the mirror and be like, all right, like we've got one option here. Mm-hmm. We've got to get it done. But I'll think back to early in my career. You know, I was 21 years old, fresh out of college, my very first year teaching. And I felt like I failed over and over and over again. And, you know, part of it was I was green. I had a lot to learn. It was new, you know, but at the same time, it was just also a lot of my mindset needed to shift. Mm-hmm. So one of the examples I share in Personal and Authentic is I think back to that first year, I was so fortunate to have a mentor across the hall that also wasn't afraid to call me out one-on-one, man-to-man, to essentially say, Tom, like, we don't do that here. And so there was this one time that very first year, I had a really challenging class. But again, I don't think I was this classroom management guru at 21 years old and fresh out of college. But at the same time, I went down to the faculty room. I lost my cool. I hit my hand on the desk and I start kind of reaming into this one kid. And it was just in front of my colleagues. The student wasn't been there. It had been kind of that morning. I was having a bad day and I just let it fly. I just started to vent in front of everybody. And I will tell you, it was a little while later when my mentor pulled me aside one-on-one. It wasn't in front of anybody else. He wasn't, you know, demeaning me in front of colleagues. He wasn't talking about me when I left the room, but he pulled me aside and literally got in my face and was like, you don't do that. Like, we don't act like that here, and really called me out on it in the sense of he really pushed me because I was just sharing about a student in a derogatory way. The student wasn't listening. I'd called home. Parents were calling me back, you know, and it was really one of the most humbling moments of my career. And to be honest with you, I really think I'm glad that it happened in the sense of it taught me a lot because I was so focused on me and my rules and why they weren't, you know, working for me and why wasn't the parent calling me back that I really couldn't see him. And by the time I really understood that child's story, I will tell you, I cried like a baby when I realized like, here's the why. Yeah. In the story behind understanding why that child was. And so I'm glad that I had a mentor that wasn't afraid to call me out. And to be honest, I think we need to do more of that in not just education, but in any realm. And again, it wasn't derogatory. It was one-on-one with a mentor to say like, we don't do that here. Because to challenge other educators watching the podcast, how many times do you sit in a faculty room and somebody's complaining, somebody's complaining, everybody just looks the other way. Yeah. You know, and I think part of it is because like, I see, I'm not somebody that enjoys conflict. I think people that enjoy conflict are just like sick, like, right. but I think we need to like, cause that whole idea around silence is consent. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really glad that I had a mentor that called me out man to man and just said like, knock it off and like really talk some sense into me to help me see it differently. So I had to pull myself back up. I remember being a little bit shaken up being like, man, like I just got told. And but it's a good thing in retrospect. And it really, it's a humbling moment in my career, but at the end of the day, like, he was right. And I'm glad that it wasn't just everybody head nodding in a faculty room, because you know what? I probably would have done it again the next week.
Yeah. And it's so good that you had that mentor that, you know, took the courage to call you out, right? Because like you said, you came in green. A lot of us, you know, we transition from college into the classroom, and there's a lot we don't know. There's a lot about our students we don't know about classroom management, right? We think we know it all as we start teaching it. You know, I can think back to that time as well, right? Like, you know, what am I doing wrong? Who is anybody to say that I am doing anything wrong because you think you're doing everything right? Like, you're, you know, you have a lot to learn, but I think, you know, he did the right thing. And just calling you out, and like you're saying, the you know, if we use that a little bit more with our colleagues, and, you know,
yeah, and it was done again, and Dana, in like a very respectful way, but I knew that he loved me enough that he had my best interests at heart. You know, how many times does something like that happen in a faculty room? Somebody blows up, somebody leaves, and then it becomes kind of whisper down the lane. Now I'm two grade level. Did you just see what happened with what's going on with Sue? And I can't believe, and now I become gossiping about it as opposed to addressing the issue. And so I'm really blessed to have had a colleague that had the courage to be like, Tom, like, as your mentor, like, it's not going to fly, because it wasn't just being a mentor on the teaching and learning side, the curriculum side. This is the next student, try this lesson. It wasn't that. It was also the mentor, to be honest, on being a professional.
And, you know, that's true. We could work in the same building for years and have a negative attitude and nobody calls us out on it. But, you know, some of those things, you know, and that often comes from administrators in the building, but, you know, some of those things need to be nipped in the bud. And it's also about the relationships that the adults have in the building, because a lot of the time, you know, those negative attitudes are ignored. And then the person just repeats year after year.
You know, Dan, I can share a quick story about that as well. I can think back to being an early principal, and you know, there was this one individual in one of the particular buildings I'm in. I'm not going to be too specific there for obvious reasons. That was kind of known to be this negative person. Like, let's say I was in a different building prior, and like I knew about this person miraculously, right? And my first year in that building as an administrator, something happened, and I'll be totally honest, throw myself under the bus here again. I knew that if I addressed it, like World War III was going to break out. And I'll be totally honest and say, I looked the other way, kind of being like, I just hope it doesn't happen again. So then a number of months later, like things, you know, over time, things kind of went subdued a little bit, and we kept moving forward until the springtime, when something happened like that again, same individual. And I knew that my teachers knew. And so I called the person in, and again, had this challenging conversation, and actually used some of the words that I just shared with you of like, listen, we don't do that here. We don't act like that here. That is not okay as a staff member to be doing that. And I'm going to support you in any way you need to, but you need to understand, like, that crosses a line that we're not okay with. Right. And shortly thereafter, this, I can hear things yelling down the hallway in a classroom about how I'm this bad guy and how it's my fault and how, like, you know, it's my issue, and, you know, all the whole thing down there, until the next day I had a staff member come in, and I will say she was one of my best people in the world, a far greater teacher than I ever was. She walked into my office that next morning, looked me in the eye, and said, Tom, the only thing I'm going to say to you is, like, we've been waiting for a long, long time for an administrator to actually address the issue. So I just wanted to say, thanks, I'm leaving. And she turned around and she walked back out. The reason I share that is to not pat myself on the back. The reason to share that is to say, the very first time when I think about that fall, when I missed it, I also told my teachers, by not saying anything, by not addressing it, when we get a challenging situation come up, rather than hit it head on, look the other way and hope it goes away and that's going to be okay, because that's essentially, as the building leader, what I did. And again, not liking somebody, that not being somebody that wants conflict, I just kind of hoping it would go away. I realized that people were always watching. And when I chose not to handle issues, it also sent the message that that's an okay way to do it. If you have issues in your classroom, just try and look the other way. And I realized how poorly I modeled that. And it was that side comment from one of my best people in the world being like, we've been wondering for a long time, like, when's somebody actually going to address that issue? And so that was a real learning point for me, especially as an early administrator there as well.
Yeah. And I think that's really important. Like, you make that parallel between the classroom and as a school leader, like, we can't ignore certain things in the classroom, right? We need to face those with certain students. And then as well, as a leader, you know, it's a hard thing to have those type of conversations, but, you know, the behavior is going to continue. And, you know,
and maybe it's like, if I'm a teacher watching this, maybe it's that student in your classroom that you're almost like fearful of those parents. And I can say, again, I remember being an early teacher and being hesitant sometimes to reach out to parents. And then all of a sudden something large happens and you've had all these strings of things that have happened. And then this is like the first time you're reaching out. Mm-hmm. And I guess the flip side then is, how can we always amplify the positive as well? You know, if I'm that classroom teacher, how do I make sure? And when I was that building principal, I'd work with my staff of like, how do we make sure that our students have, especially in the beginning of the year, 2, 3, 4, 5 positive contacts before we have to make that call home that said, your kid's acting like a knucklehead and I need your help. Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that's also on us too. It's again, it's, we can say we're busy, we don't have time for that, but that communication, whether you're in a leadership position like building principal or a leadership position like a teacher, that stuff's imperative.
Yeah. And I remember learning that way back in my student teaching, you know, make those positive phone calls. And, you know, sometimes it was hard for me to like, okay, you know, got to think of some good things to say about some kids, but just, you know, that helps build the relationships. And that kind of moves into that piece that I wanted to talk about. You have a story about your daughter in terms of social emotional learning and how teachers, you know, can use more social emotional learning and, you know, over this past year.
Yeah, so absolutely. And it's ironic because here we are filming this podcast. And literally moments ago, my daughter left the doctor's office and I was checking in. How's she doing? Is she doing okay? Has she had any sort of reactions? So to share the story, one of the things that I do with educators often and getting to speak with a lot of groups is I'll put some data on a screen. And I will say, you know, this is pre-COVID, because obviously, you know, anytime we talk about kids out, whatever the case, everybody jumps to COVID right now, which is certainly understandable because it's front and center on everybody's radar. But this is pre-COVID. And I'll put some data on a screen and I'll say, let's pretend you're getting this child tomorrow. And this child in the last 14 months pre-COVID, she's been absent 35 times. And in the past 14 months, she's been tardy 20 times. Be real. And I'll say, like, give me some judgments educators might make. And I've done this in front of thousands and thousands of people. And we'll hear time and time again, judgments that, to be honest, I'm sure I made when I was a teacher in the classroom. And honestly, even as an administrator, things like, why don't the parents care? Maybe the kid's lazy. Maybe there's drugs. Maybe there, maybe she's pregnant. Maybe she's working multiple jobs. Maybe she's staying up all night playing video games. Why doesn't she care? And going on and on and on and on and on. And I share the next part of the story and I'll say, well, let me tell you, remember the child I introduced you to when I kicked off the keynote or when I kicked off the workshop, you see that data right there? That's my daughter. And the place always goes silent. And then I start to share the story. Like, do you understand what it was like when she was 10 months old, the night that we had no idea that she had such significant food allergies and we had friends over and they brought over some hummus and we didn't feed it to her. She was only 10 months old, but they're sloppy eaters. And she got a little bit on her hand and she just wiped her eye. And to share the story of what it was like as daddy to watch her turn completely red and to basically her body start to shut down and watch as she started to gasp for air, being unable to breathe in just a couple minute period, like that moment right there. Or what if what it was like to bring her and run her to the car and literally do 100 miles an hour in a 30 to get to the hospital, literally begging God to save my daughter because she couldn't breathe and she was gasping for air. Like that moment right there. Like, what if I told you what it was like the moment that we ran into that ER and screaming for an EpiPen and a nurse came running out of the back and stabbed her in the leg and watched some color return to her and watch her like start to catch her breath again? Like, what if I told you about that moment? Or what it was like that night as an educator, as daddy, just laying next to her bed, listening to every single breath to make sure that she was still breathing. Like that moment right there. So when I start to tell the story and I start to say, well, in every one of those 35 absences, she was 2 hours from our home undergoing food allergy therapy as the first child in the Northeast for sesame, what she was severely allergic to at that time. I shared earlier just a moment ago that she's now doing this therapy for tree nuts and she just left the doctor's office yet again. Here we are filming on an afternoon of a school day yet again for tree nuts, a different allergy that she's walking down this path of. So when I start to share the story and I start to say how, you know, in those 35 absences, she said every single time, mommy or daddy, I really wish I could be in school today. And in 19 of the 20 tardies, one of them, we were just late. Sorry, signed the slip, got it back to you, right? But in 19 of the 20 tardies, it was because she was 2 hours from home undergoing therapy, and we'd get back to school about 1 o'clock in the afternoon so she could walk into math class. And I'm so blessed to have a teacher, thank you, Mrs. Thomas, in second grade, Mr. Moyer in third grade, that when she would walk in, they would just put her arm around her and be like, Paisley, we're so glad you're here. We missed you, kiddo. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, here's the five things you need. Mm-hmm. So I share all of that because after 14 months of therapy, that little girl, we almost lost her multiple times because of about one seed of sesame. That's how severe it was. She now eats the equivalent of 2,000 seeds every single day. And I call it the hidden stories within, because if she were to come and sit on my lap right now and stare in the face and be on camera with me, you would have no idea.
Yeah.
And the piece, the part of that too is, that's the story. That's the idea that we all have these hidden stories within. Yeah, it's something for her. She thinks about every single day. Anytime she's at school, because we're hybrid right now, she's at school and she walks into a cafeteria, it crosses her mind about how severe her allergies are and how she's got to be careful. And it's a hidden story. It's not something you can physically see. But hidden stories can also be good. Like maybe you're listening to the podcast and you got something coming up this weekend and you're super excited, but like nobody around you knows that you're going to have, you know, a date night with your spouse for your anniversary coming up. It's a hidden story, right? And so point being that we all have these hidden stories within, and it's why we have to lead with an empathy lens. You know, I'm a fan of data. I think educational data plays a role. It definitely does. It tells part of the story, but making decisions based on data without understanding the story, and we can make really bad decisions for kids if we're not careful. Mm-hmm. And so I share all of that because it's really that SEL side. It's the leading with an empathy lens. It's recognizing that that's just one story from one girl walking into a classroom of things that are on her heart that you can't see, and how often we're quickly to judge. And when I say that, I'm talking about myself. It's why I'm personal and authentic. When I shared her story, I talk about how the difference between making a judgment and having empathy is understanding the story. Mm-hmm. And so for me, SEL is really getting to how do we understand the stories of our learners so we can best meet their needs. And let's back it up a notch. There's also, I believe, the SEL side for teachers. We talk about the whole child, because of course our kids are our priority. But when we back it up, like we as adults have to understand the same thing about the teacher across the hall. I mean, maybe their marriage is falling apart. And here we are, like, we're so quick to judge about like why they're showing up late and why they keep closing their door. And like, we don't think necessarily, when I say that, I'm talking about myself, about the human side. Mm-hmm. It's how do we make sure that we understand that teaching and learning and the whole school experience is far more than math, reading, writing, and test scores. Mm-hmm. And understand that this is about interests and passions and strengths and how people are individuals. And we need to make sure that we recognize that first, whether we're a teacher, a principal, or superintendent. But I call that section the hidden stories within. And I, with my daughter's permission, share that part of her story to help people have that empathy lens. So you know that child that's not logging in at all to your virtual classroom right now, like instead of taking it so personal, stepping back and saying like, well, what's going on there? Maybe connectivity is an issue. Maybe they're babysitting their siblings because they're the oldest one as a third grader that's home with three kids because mom's working two jobs and mom's not home. And not to say that we can just start making excuses, and that's not what I mean. We still want to have high expectations, but let's not rush to judgment, especially right now in the midst of a pandemic where anxiety and fear are so incredibly high and trauma is as high as it's ever been.
And that's so inspiring to hear, like, you know, your daughter, you can't tell, you know, by looking at her, but, you know, these reasons for her absences. I remember I worked with kids as a dean and a lot of these absences that were excused because of doctor's notes, but it was getting to know the families also. Why were these kids at the doctor's? Finding out, you know, the story, like you said, the hidden story behind the reasons why the kids weren't coming to school. Like you said, also something, you know, we need to get to know our staff more, and not everybody's wanting to share. Either it's a parent of a student or a staff member, but just have that empathy, have the understanding, right?
Yeah. Especially, and sometimes, Dana, when I share that, some people will push back and say, but we're not always going to know the story. They're not going to. And that's right. We're not. And it's why we have to lead with that empathy lens instead of making those judgments so quickly.
And how does this leading with empathy really tie into school culture and the school culture piece? Because, you know, I think if you lead with empathy, if you, you know, engage the staff in, you know, taking on the trauma-informed practices and social emotional learning, it can change a school culture. So what's your take on that and making that shift in school culture?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, in our world right now, I guess it always is, it's so easy to point the finger, isn't it? And you think about, well, if our president would actually just, if our governor would finally reopen this, if our school board would just, if our superintendent would finally, if my principal would just, like, it's so easy to point the finger, isn't it? It's a lot harder to look in the mirror and point the finger. And I'm talking about myself when I say that. I can point the finger pretty easily. But my governor of Pennsylvania would actually just, that's an easy thing to do. Mm-hmm. But looking in a mirror and saying, well, what role do I play with that? So when I think about the culture side, it's like, how do we make sure that every person in a building really owns the culture? Mm-hmm. Now, listen, I'll be real. There's toxic principals running toxic buildings that are really tough places to be. Like, I know that. I've seen that firsthand. Mm-hmm. I've experienced that firsthand. I know what that feeling looks like. But what do you choose to do? Do you choose to point like, well, this one person is going to make the 70 of us miserable all time? And listen, I get it. I know how that can happen. But what if 70 other people in that building try to do everything they can to make that the greatest place to work, even in spite of the principal? Like, why not? Right. And so when we think about culture, it's so easy to pass the buck. How do I make sure I own my part of it? And so when I close that door and I'm in my classroom, I've got to own the classroom culture, right, as that teacher. And it's easy. Well, my students don't, because there we go again, pointing the finger. Well, if I didn't have these three students, this would be a because again, we're pointing the finger. And so how do I make sure when I'm coming to work, I'm part of the solution and not part of the problem, right? How do I help create an environment where I want to be no matter what my circle of influence is? Maybe you're a support staff member feeling this and being like, well, I don't have my own classroom. I'm certainly not the building principal. And I only get to see kids a couple hours here and over here at lunch. Okay, well, in the lunchroom, how do you create an environment where people want to be? Because if you're in a school system, let's face it, you're a leader for kids, right? And some people look at it by, again, passing that buck. And so how do we own that? So from culture, really culture to me comes down to trust. So the question becomes, how do we build trust? A lot of times I'll be coaching superintendents, coaching principals, especially if they're in a district in first couple of years and they're trying to shift some practices. This stuff takes time. You can't just be a new principal showing up saying, all right, staff, we're going to have the best culture in the world, flip the switch, and tomorrow it's this utopia. It doesn't happen. It takes a long time to build. But the flip side, it can also be shattered in an email. And we've got to be really conscious of that. So the first part to me is about owning it. The second, and looking in the mirror, the second part is about trust and how do we build trust with people? And I really believe we build trust by people by modeling the desired outcomes. If I'm a principal in a building saying to my staff, well, don't stand and deliver. You can't be stand and deliver in a classroom. And yet every single faculty meeting is stand and deliver. Like I'm saying one thing and doing another. If I'm a teacher in a classroom that says, I expect you to own your work, student A, you better own your work there, student B. But I show up 2 days later at the in-service day, putting my hands up, being like, well, this is just dumb. I'm not going to do any of this. I don't like I'm expecting other people to do what I'm not doing myself. And so to me, trust comes down to model. You want to build trust in the classroom, model the desired outcomes each and every day. You want to build trust as a building or a district leader, model the desired outcomes. And here's the thing, you're going to screw it up. Because you're human. You're going to make the wrong call. You're going to do the wrong thing. You're going to say the wrong thing. So in those moments, we've got to own it. There's such power if I'm a principal standing in front of a staff and saying, you know, gang, last week we were trying to do these schedules. I made that call and I thought that was going to work and it didn't. And I recognize that and I'm going to own it. I apologize about that because I know I wasted some of your time and I certainly didn't mean to do that. But here's what we're going to do next because of your feedback, but the things over here, but we own it, right? Again, not just passing the buck, not being the principal that turns around and says, well, if these two teachers actually did their job, that schedule would have worked, right? And so how do we make sure that we can own it? And so when we look at the culture side, it's about modeling, it's about trust, and it's about owning the piece to learning, no matter what my role might be, because in those pieces, it's we've got to see ourselves as a valuable part of that, as opposed to somebody else's job.
Yeah. And that kind of takes me back to like, you know, in the classroom, sometimes, you know, a student will call you out, like I would write things on the board and, you know, sometimes I would make a typo or spelling mistake and, you know, and you, as a teacher, after taught a couple of years, you know, you let your guard down and, you know, oh, sorry, you know, I made that spelling mistake or something. You own that mistake. But, you know, I think that's very important to know as leaders, like, you know, if things don't go well, that they own that because that way they're more vulnerable. They seem more human, right? And they're more approachable from the staff lens as well.
Yeah, here's what I would say about that. I really believe the higher up you go, the more challenging it becomes. Mm-hmm, I work with superintendents all across the country, and you walk into a room, and I love my superintendents. They've got some of the hardest jobs in the world. They really, really do. But they've got their tie on, their board members already eat. They got another board member calling. Their job is to always make sure it looks like it's always together. And we've got an answer. They need to exude that calm and always having it together, because there's a lot of people looking up at them. Mm-hmm. But here's the reality. When a superintendent makes the wrong call, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You own it. I saw a superintendent do this recently where they canceled school because of a snow day. They were calling this huge storm, right? And this has been a crazy throughout so much of the country with crazy weather. And they called it, and it never snowed. Like, things changed. And then parents are firing away. You called a snow day, and we didn't, you know, like, it didn't even snow. And and they got on there and said, look, I'm sorry that call ended up being wrong. Let me walk you through the process. Here's how we determine, and here's how we work with the weather services and the police and the transportation and all these folks. And collectively, we wanted to keep kids safe, and they owned it. It wasn't just like, sorry, well, the weatherman told me to cancel, so we canceled. They owned it. And so, you know, it's not going to ever be this perfect scenario, because you're always going to have people, especially in some sort of leadership role, just they're pointing the finger, right, in that regard. But I think in those moments, I think that vulnerability really is key.
Yeah. And there's going to always be people that don't agree with your decision as a leader. So, you know, but I think, coming and just speaking to that, like, you know, this, why the decision was made the way it was, and, you know, so important. I wanted to shift a little bit and talk about your work with tech, and you were a former tech director, and a lot of what you talk about on the Future Ready video casts are use of technology. You've talked to a lot of tech directors, and so I wanted to hear your thoughts about the effective use of ed tech post-pandemic, kind of going into that post-pandemic world next school year, and what you see as something that we're continuing to use in the next several years.
Yeah. So let me preface it by saying, as a former tech director, as somebody, as a former teacher and principal that invested a lot in technology, that really enjoys technology, with that preface, let me share it this way. Mm-hmm. Prior to the pandemic, we had spent more and more money each and every year. It was into one study to the tune of like $17 billion in a given year for educational technology. And I'll go on record and saying much of it was a total waste, total waste. And we think about these pieces, the pandemic has, and if anything, accelerated it, because I have no numbers. I've seen no new numbers on how much is even spent just during the pandemic. But here's the bottom line. Just because something is digital doesn't mean it's any good. Mm-hmm. Now, the pandemic has put us in an interesting spot where without technology, kids couldn't have any sort of learning, right? Some people refer to it as achievement gaps. I refer to it as an opportunity gap. Some of the work we do at Future Ready Schools, because we're an equity-focused organization, is around looking at and supporting the 16.9 million children, disproportionately, by the way, it's our Black and brown kids, that do not have internet access at home. Because if I didn't have the technology, if I didn't have the internet connection, if I didn't have the device, I physically couldn't do the learning. And how many kids, millions of kids during the pandemic have been influenced there as well. So on one hand, looking at it from the effective use of ed tech, that digital divide, as we would call it, has been talked about for well over two decades, the has and the has nots. The good news is a lot of that is closed. Education Superhighway, one of our partners, estimates that in school, it's over 99% of our schools have the connectivity that they need. And that really is accelerated because of things like E-rate and districts making it a priority over the past decade. But the pandemic obviously shifted that, when now we're basically being measured by what kids had access at home, right? You want to talk about looking at poverty, you know, and those types of things. Teachers, again, and educators, again, are again tried to being forced to solve the poverty throughout our country because of the role they're playing when kids' classrooms are now in their bedrooms, right? So that's one whole side of it we could go down. But the other side, when we think about, especially post-pandemic, is sometimes we get through these notions of, like, just because something's digital, it's good. And let me give you an example of a microcosm that I see all around the country. I get to go to so many different conferences, probably keynote a good 40, 50 conferences in a given year. And so I get to see a lot. If I was going to do two breakout sessions and I wanted to fill a room, if I built it as 50 apps and 50 minutes, that place would be like crawling with people. Fire marshal would get there, get them out, because everybody wants that quick fix. Now, listen, there's a time to be able to expose people to things like that. There's some inherent value in there. But some of the problem then becomes, here's this cool tool I learned. Where can I try and fit it in over here, right? Which is like really a backwards approach. But the other side then, if I had on the other side of that conference, you know, shifting pedagogy, with, you know, something related to technology, you get four assistant superintendents sitting in the front row. How do I know? Because I see it all the time, all over the place. And so at the end of the day, what is it that really works with ed tech? Because I'm somebody that's very active on social media. You'll see folks on social media all jacked up, like, this app is a game changer. This thing is a game changer. And what I'll say is, like, there are certain things, if I'm for students with special needs, that, yeah, something is a game changer. If it helps a child that can't, you know, that can't read because of some sort of disability, whatever the case might be, and it improves life for them, absolutely. I would say that's a game changer. Some of our stuff for our special needs students absolutely can be. But 99 times out of 100, when I hear that, it's like this cool new tool, which, by the way, is also pretty low level. So we did a study with Dr. Linda Darling-Hammond, probably the top known educational researcher in the world, and her team at Stanford, to look at over a year in this meta-analysis of all these studies out there, like, what is it that really works with ed tech? And to boil it down to a handful of things, number one, it's the use of technology to explore, to design, to create. Explore, design, create. But if we step back, that shouldn't be rocket science. Because if we look at, like, Bloom's taxonomy or anything like that, it's really just the higher level skills, right? One of the things that I think we have to be careful of, there's models out there like SAMR. A lot of people will point to SAMR, and SAMR has a place, but SAMR doesn't tell you the level of learning. You can be really high on SAMR and really pretty low on learning if we're not careful. And a lot of times what happens is we get all jazzed up about these apps or these tools. Like, just because something's on a Google Doc doesn't mean it's higher level than handwriting. And in fact, from a memory end, handwriting is actually better than typing in a Google Doc, right? Now, are there some positives with collaboration and revision and all those? Absolutely. And those we have to take into account. Are there some things that we do with technology that cause efficiency? Absolutely. So there's things we may want to do that maybe it's not a deeper level per se, but it more efficient. Well, efficiency, if it saves us time, increases time that we have with students. But from a learning end, I think we can be really guilty of putting kids on devices, using certain apps and tools, and it really being, if we're honest about it, low level learning. So the more time we spend with the technology, the more time we spend with low level learning. And we've got to be really conscious of that. The other piece from the study, there was one of our other findings really looked at with something that I would deem, like, every great teacher's always know what's right for one kid is going to be different than another. And so when we know that more personalized piece to it, just because we're doing it with student A, do we really need to do it with student B? Or is there a better way for them to learn it, or a different opportunity for them to learn it? The other piece that I would say, one of the things that we often don't talk about from research around the effective use of technology, Michael Fullan often shares his quote on how pedagogy is the driver and technology is the accelerator. And, and I love that analogy, because technology really amplifies or accelerates. The flip side, like, as we've talked about how it can accelerate, you know, positive practices and create more opportunities or deeper opportunities. I mean, let's face it, when we have the world's information at our fingertips, what becomes possible is really, really amazing, right? The flip side to some of the evidence that we see in that area is it can also speed up the rate of failure.
Yeah.
And we don't talk about that side a whole lot. So teachers that don't have some of those skills, or we look at some of those places with technology, and by the way, we've seen more growth from teachers because they've had to in this area, right? The technology skills now versus like a 1 year ago right now, amazing. And we commend teachers for the incredible work they're doing with that. But being that accelerator, we've got to be careful, because it can also accelerate the rate of failure when it comes to things not going so well. And if you've sat in a classroom where things aren't playing, videos aren't playing, we aren't working, all of a sudden we've wasted 30 minutes because something wasn't working, whatever that case might be, where, you know, doing it in a different way, we would have not wasted that time. And that's just one example related to that.
Yeah, and I agree. It's not the end all be all for all students, right? Like you mentioned, having students handwrite things sometimes, or, you know, do that math problem on a sheet of paper, or, you know, just the planning and the revision on a sheet of paper, things, you know, working things out in your head, right? Not asking Siri all the answers. Like my 11-year-old daughter recently got an Apple Watch, right? And she's like, she's doing her vocab for her language arts, and she's asking Siri, what's the definition of X, Y, and Z, right? And
Well, it's going back to what's the best tool for that point in time. And there's going to be times where a device is absolutely a big part of it. And then let's recognize there's going to be times where it's not, right? And that's okay. Like for me personally, I love to read, but to be honest, I don't love to read off a computer. Mm-hmm. And so let's not kid ourselves to say just because the student is reading a book that's a PDF on a screen, that's any better than it is. I'd much rather snuggle up with a book than snuggle up with my computer to read. But again, inherently, there's no difference there. And so when we look at some of those pieces, it's easy to get jazzed up, and you see it all the time on social media, mm-hmm. about whatever the case might be, you know, like, oh, let's in one example, you know, I'm totally paperless. Like at the end of the day, mm-hmm. so what? Like, yeah. if it's low level, why are we sharing that? Right. Yeah. And so, and let's even say administrators sometimes, and again, I say this from experience, like we can, as principals, reinforce low level learning without even realizing it. And mm-hmm. I'll say that to a whole bunch of principals, and they'll look at me like, come on. I'll say, all right, let's think about your quick little walkthrough form. Pull it out. How many times on our little walkthrough form does it say students are using technology, and we check it off? Mm-hmm. Here's my question for you. So what?
Yeah.
What if it was all low level? Check. What are we doing? They used it, so it's a good thing. Check. Mm-hmm. Well, what if it was all low level? And so we've got to be really careful, because indirectly we could reinforce low level stuff just by saying you're using technology. Check. Great job. Mm-hmm. So I say all of that not to demean anything teachers are doing, because you will always find me as pro teacher, as positive teacher as possible. But we also have to be really real as to what's worth investing the time in and what's not. And it's a tool. It's not the end goal. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so is the tool going to accelerate the learning? If so, use it. Are there things that it's going to slow down, or maybe it's better just to put it away for a given time, then put it away. And that's okay too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a little while ago in this talk about EdTech, you mentioned the equity gap, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on the homework gap with equity, you know, as we go into the 21-22 school year. And, you know, that's been kind of an issue. I mean, when I taught up until 2016, I didn't assign homework that often on the computer, right? I'd give a handout or something if it was homework. And, you know, looking at now that a lot of kids had to learn from home, what do you think? Should homework be assigned on tech, or what are your thoughts?
So you always have to look at, so if a student can't do it, then what? Mm-hmm. So let me give you some thoughts on that. At Future Ready Schools, we've been really working on this issue since inception, about 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is the homework gap. It was coined the homework gap by Jessica Rosenwurzel. And sometimes, and I originally, and knowing her, an incredible FCC commissioner, she's the acting lead commissioner right now for the FCC, you know, push back a little bit internally, being like, but it's more than homework. And it was, mm-hmm. well, that's what Congress understands. That's why it's coined that. It's really an opportunity gap, the connectivity gap. There's all sorts of research out there about families that aren't connected, you know, they don't get jobs nearly as fast, obviously, mm-hmm. right? And those kinds of things. So when we look at the homework gap, part of it is COVID. First of all, I'll say COVID didn't create equity issues. COVID amplified equity issues that have always existed. Mm-hmm. Last March, when things started to shut down and districts started to say, we can't be in person, now we've got to be remote, became the like, oh shoot, how do we connect mm-hmm. kids that don't have access at home? Here's my pushback. What were you doing the week prior? Because mm-hmm. you were assigning homework. 70% mm-hmm. of our teachers that are ask kids to do something digital pre-pandemic outside of school. Mm-hmm. And yet 16.9 million children, that's in our latest study for Future Ready Schools, didn't have access. What then? Like, I wonder how many times, and again, I don't say this as anti-teacher, I just say this to be real. How many times in 11th grade social studies class was the teacher walking over being like, Johnny, you didn't do your homework again? I told you to put that in Schoology in the discussion board. Johnny, this is the second night in a row. Johnny, they're like, when you hit the real world, there's no second chances with this. They're like, zero for the assignment, checks it off. And there's Johnny, the 11th grader, being like, I couldn't get anywhere and we don't have the internet at home, so I couldn't do it. And I've never met a student that wants to put their hand up and tell us in front of the whole class.
Yeah.
So being really conscious of this as a teacher by always saying, hey, if you can't do this digitally at home, and number one, can we even identify who these students mm-hmm. are, right? Well, now we can, because of the pandemic, we've had to, it's forced us to. But here's my teller, if you're a district level leader, what I'm pushing on them right now is, so when the pandemic ends and everybody can be back face-to-face, all the hotspots, all the connectivity and all the things that we've purchased, are we going to take it all back? Mm-hmm. from students that don't have connectivity at home, and then say what? Well, now we're going, That's going to tell you what people really feel about equity related to that. Disproportionately, it's our Black and Hispanic families. The numbers yet again show that. We also did research, and you can check it out at futureready.org/homework gap is one way to look at that. Right now, as of this filming, we are really pushing on Congress, and there's some things out there and some bills out there to help close these gaps. It's just that it's very difficult when you've got over 15,000 school districts to close this individually by district. And let's face it, as a former CIO, I've never met a technology office that's like, we've got more money than we know what to do with and more staffing. So we're just looking to take new things on, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's added like tripled the number of devices probably in the last 5 years and probably has the same staff or less than they did. And so when we look at that from a tech end, yes, there's some things that are more efficient that we can do in larger scale, but you know, just asking every individual district to solve it at a problem is not a global solution. And so we're really pushing Congress to step up. And I have some hope with the new administration, with some new leadership that values and recognizes this learning gap, this opportunity gap, if kids aren't connected. It is really challenging, though, that last mile. When we look at like remote islands in Alaska, like nobody's running fiber out there for a couple places. And that really is a challenge. And so I actually do have a lot of hope in things like SpaceX with Elon Musk, and they're launching satellites to be able to support places that are really, really remote. Because at the end of the day, your cable companies and places to lay fiber, they're not going to do it out of the goodness of their heart. But it's expensive stuff, right? And so when we look at those kinds of things, I think that's where innovation can help slow some of those gaps, as opposed to just running fiber to the one house that's, you know, 10 miles out by itself. It's nobody's going to do that. And so how can we have innovative ways to solve solutions like that?
And that's something that we'll be interested to see. Like a lot of these, at least in Colorado, a lot of these cable companies that are providing the free internet, right? The free Wi-Fi hotspots. So, you know, will those continue? Will there still be that partnership between the companies and the school districts? That's something we need to see, right?
Dana, the other thing that I'll say though about equity, I know our time is short here, but I wouldn't want somebody to walk away from listening to this conversation to think about equity just being devices and connectivity. Mm-hmm. It's a small piece of overall equity. You know, if I'm a principal, am I looking at my discipline rates and disparities between my different groups? Am I looking at our curriculum? Where can the students see mirrors of themselves? Or, you know, is our read alouds and things like that in our curriculum actually reinforcing some stereotypes and we're not processing that? Or look at our hiring practices. Does our administrative team, do our teaching staff resemble the demographics of our school or of our district? If not, what are we doing about it? Mm-hmm. So how can we be intentional about it? And we can look at this. It's such a large, overwhelming topic. Yeah. The key is to recognize we've got to remove our own blinders to things that, you know, that we've got to be really conscious of. To give you an example of that, when I told early on in the podcast my daughter's story about food allergies, well, guess what? As daddy, I'm a huge advocate around food allergies and support and research. But I'll be totally honest, before my daughter was born, wasn't on my radar. Why? Because it's now personal for me. And so when I look at these kinds of things, how do we make sure that we can remove our own lenses and our own blinders? Because if you've never been somebody that tried to work without having the access to the internet for long periods of time, maybe you don't have so much empathy for those students that don't have, because maybe you don't think a whole lot about it. Mm-hmm. Go a week in their shoes and watch how your productivity slows down and how you can't do things and how you're unable to print and scan and do these pieces. And then go redo it and rethink it, right? And so how do we make sure we lead with that empathy lens? Well, we're talking about the stories of our kids and our staff, or we talk about those things. To me, equity is a non-negotiable. It is not a checkbox, we're done. It is not some, we're going to have one little group over there that's going to talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. It's how do we make sure our systems and our structures do not hold students down, and making sure that they have every opportunity that they want and that they can be afforded regardless of their zip code.
I think that's so important to remember as we move into the post-pandemic world, right? Everybody has equal access. Everybody can see themselves in their curriculum. And, you know, I've been working with that for years and, you know, making more inclusive curriculum and, you know, like you're saying, hiring policies, you know, the staff, you know, everything that we're doing in a school building, like, you know, making sure that our students feel welcome.
Yeah, for sure.
So as we wrap up the podcast, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
to me, so much of the work right now is just making sure we're looking at it with an empathy lens, whether it's the story of one of our students, the story of a colleague, the student that's unconnected, the student, the person that's just overwhelmed, the trauma that we have out there, just in terms of the pandemic, the fear, the anxiety, it's leading with that empathy lens, leading with a mindset that doesn't take things so personal and backs up and recognizing, look, like this isn't about us. If you've got that ticked off parent or that student, step back, don't take it personal and say like, what's the real issue here? How do I support this? What can I do? You know, what can I do differently or whatever that case might be. But for me, empathy is such a key to our world right now. And I mentioned vulnerability earlier. I think they can go hand in hand with that, but make sure to lead with an empathy lens.
That's so important. And where can people connect with you and find you online and find out more about Future Ready Schools?
Sure. So for Future Ready, futureready.org, encourage you to check that out. Bipartisan nonprofit. We don't sell anything. Lots of events, lots of resources, all totally free. No sales pitch there at all. Encourage you to check that out. Also going to be launching some about 10 events for the spring, all virtual events, all totally free. Lots of fun there. Personally, you can connect with me on my website, thomascmurray.com. And then that'll link to lots of social media. Twitter is at Thomas C. Murray, Facebook and Instagram are thomascmurray.edu. So I'd love to connect with folks there.
Well, it's been great having you on the Out of the Trenches podcast today. Thanks so much and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Dana. Thanks for having me.